This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or Google Play or wherever you listen, and rate and review us wherever you're listening to us. Today, I'm talking with Eric Boehm. He's a reporter at Reason, and we are talking about the Janus v. AFSCME decision of the Supreme Court, which came down earlier today, a 5-4 decision that has major repercussions for the way that public sector unions can collect money from dues-paying members who may not want to be a dues-paying member. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Nick.
Okay, do a quick, what's the one-line summary of the case?
The one-line summary of the case is that this is an overturning of about a little more than 40-year-old precedent that said public sector unions could collect dues even from members that weren't part of the union, so they could force you to pay dues to them.
And well, not members per se, but then it becomes, it's kind of workers,
right?
That the public sector unions had a right to say, you know, we're spending X amount of dollars a year on collective bargaining, and you've got to pay even if you don't want to belong to the union or you don't belong to the union.
Right, that's correct. The theory here, and the theory that was upheld by the Supreme Court back in the 70s, and this ruling, we'll probably talk a bit about it today, this Abood ruling, said that, public sector unions can charge not the full membership dues to non-members, but if they are representing people as part of a collective bargaining unit that are not their members, they can still charge them a quote-unquote fair share fee. And so you had Mark Janus, who was an employee in the state of Illinois, works works for one of the state departments in Illinois, and he has spent the last several years actually working this case through the court system, challenging. He says that he's paid more than $6,000 over the course of his career in $50 installments every 2 weeks to the unions, and he doesn't want to make that payment. He's not a member of the union. He says, "Hey, you can't coerce me to make these payments." And today, in that 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court agreed with him.
Well, you know, we talked to Mark Janus a while ago, and he had worked previously as a state employee in Illinois, then went back to the private sector, whatever, came back, and he helps make sure that children in the foster care or in child protective services are being taken care of. He is, kind of an interesting square guy. He was an Eagle Scout. In our interview, we talked about how he didn't like The Simpsons because he thought it was disrespectful to authority. So, I mean, this is not... it's kind of interesting because this is the type of model citizen that you tend to want. What was the basis of his argument? Because was he saying that this was, an incursion on free speech, on free association, on what? Because, the basic argument that comes out of this is that, look, whether you're in the union or not, you've got people who are going to the state house and they're saying, we want certain types of increases. We want certain types of job security. We want fair due process if you're saying we're doing a shitty job, all of that kind of stuff. And, on the face of it, it seems kind of legitimate. You don't want to have too many free riders in a system.
Yeah, no, that's a big part of this. And, just to your point about Mark Janus, the first time I met him, I was kind of taken aback too, because I expect you and I mean, we both know people that are anti-union. They're usually, very loud about it and boisterous. And he's not that at all. Yep. I mean, he's like a librarian. He's not. He's a bookkeeper, but I mean, might as well be. He's as straight-laced as you can imagine and as Midwestern as you can imagine someone to be. So his basic argument here and the argument that Justice Samuel Alito, the point that Justice Samuel Alito makes in today's majority opinion, he wrote the main opinion, is that this really is a First Amendment issue. And that's the way Janus framed it. That's the way his attorneys framed it, is that, look, I'm paying my money to this union. I don't want to pay the money, but it comes out of my paycheck anyway. And then the union uses that money for all sorts of activities, some of which I may disagree with. So I am being compelled to speak, since money equals speech. We know that from other Supreme Court precedents. I am being compelled to speak against my own interests, things that I don't want the union to
or
say on my behalf.
Or maybe even I kind of agree with, but,
even if you do agree
screw
with it.
Right. It's not. And I know he talked partly that, part of it was that philosophical principle, and then part of it is also just kind of a pragmatic thing, which has bedeviled some of these challenges before of, AFSCME, they have annual conventions and they go to Las Vegas and, they buy buffet dinners for people that, and he may not have gone there. And it's kind of like, well, how much does that go into the $50 or whatever was being taken out of his paycheck? Or they endorse candidates and they do a lot of politicking. So you could be a Republican and you have a union pushing Democratic candidates or vice versa. So, it gets into all of that.
And he talks about on that philosophical level, right. Janis also, every time I've spoken to him, he brings up the fact that he thinks every worker, even the ones who want to be part of the union, should have the right to make that choice. He says that, you know, the right to say yes to the union is just as important as the right to say no. He wants to say no, but he sees this, I think, as a broader issue of letting all workers decide what they want.
So what... What are the practical implications of this for public sector unions? And it's fascinating because if you go back, private sector or union membership peaked in the United States for overall workers back in, I guess, the 1950s at around 35% or so. For about the past 10 years or a little bit more than that, union membership has been a majority of people in union are in public sector unions. Public sector unions for the past 20 years or so have had about 35% of the workforce. 20 states still allowed unions to, for people to have to pay compulsory dues. But, you know, 30 states didn't. So, like, what is the likely outcome of this for public sector unions in the 20 states that are now affected by
this? That's an important point to make, is that this is not necessarily a nationwide ruling, because a lot of states have already done what this Supreme Court ruling does, which is say workers don't have to pay
anything.
They don't have to pay anything unless they want to, unless they sign up and unless they voluntarily make that contribution. But as you said, there's about 20 some states where this is still required.
And I guess we should also point out that it was really it was in the early 60s, I think it was like under John Kennedy, that public sector workers could actually unionize in this, because for a long time, and this was an argument way back when of saying, you know, how even Franklin Roosevelt said public sector workers shouldn't be able to unionize because the way that they're bargaining, they're not bargaining against the people paying their salary directly. They're not against management. They're going to politicians who are taking money from taxpayers. So that, you know, that's why FDR thought collective bargaining through unions.
Yeah, it is
for public
a fundamentally
workers,
different
it,
relationship. Yeah, it's a fundamentally different relationship than a union in a private sector workforce would be. Because you're bargaining against the taxpayers, but the taxpayers don't really have
a seat
at
the table. Yeah.
The politicians that the unions helped elect are usually at the table.
Until we get to what this means, this is one of the arguments and a lot of the things that we talk about at Reason. When you look at public sector compensation and whatnot, politicians love to give kind of large raises to public sector employees, particularly in the guise of compensation after the fact, or side benefits like health care, but especially retirement payments, because then not only are they not spending their own money, they're spending the taxpayer money of taxpayers who may not have even been
born. And they're going to force a politician elected 10 years from now to deal with it. Have to deal with actually paying those bills. Somebody else will. So this is tied up. This public sector union issue is tied up in a lot of these debates that our states are having right now about what is the proper level of compensation for workers? What do a proper pension plan look like? How do you fund it? Who should ultimately be on the hook if those investments don't pay off the way they should? So this ruling today changes a lot of the equations, and it's one of those where I think the consequences will kind of reverberate down through a number of different policies as we go forward.
But for instance, you know, how many what are the predictions on either side, for how many people now are going to stop paying because they can? Because,
that's the big question, right?
Yep.
There are these 20 states or so now where this ruling will say, look, union members, if you don't want to be a member of the union, if you don't want to pay those dues, you don't have to. We'll see what the number ultimately is. The best estimate, I think we have is a report that the Illinois Economic Policy Institute put out. This is a union-backed report. Mm-hmm. So this is not really anybody who's on Janice's side saying this. This is actually coming from the unions themselves. They estimate that about 726,000 workers across these 20 or so states will voluntarily choose to leave the unions.
To be clear, too, a lot of these states are big population
states.
These are,
as you would expect, as you would expect, mostly red states have already passed what we think of as red or more conservative states have already passed rules that say public sector union members don't have to be, they don't have to pay dues.
And
this mostly affects blue states.
Right, and this does not affect federal workers.
It does not. Yeah, my understanding of the ruling is that it doesn't affect federal workers.
Right.
I think this is only states. I could be wrong about that, I think this is only for states.
So what is likely to play out, though? Because, one of the things that is fascinating is that when we talk about, assuming that workers, and this is part of the union theory, theory of unionization, which is that similar workers have similar interests. They band together and extract, you know, the best deal possible from an employer. That makes sense. It's collective bargaining. And in virtually every state, you know, teachers, regardless of, you know, whether they're in a union or not, they are the single largest chunk of public sector employees. That's not going to change because of this. Mm-hmm. And our teachers who now don't have to pay, say, $50 every 2 weeks or, a few dollars
sure.
per paycheck, are they suddenly going to be like, okay, yeah, now, you know, state capital, you know, or governors and state legislatures, yeah, cut our pay, you know, screw us. What has happened, I guess, states that have flipped over?
Your point is that public sector workers are still going to exist. They're still going to be a large interest group within state government. They're all still going to have generally aligned ideas of what they want. They want better pay. They want better benefits. And they're still going to have a lot of incentives to join a union,
and
to pay those dues.
They have, you know, the leaders of their various associations, whether they're unions or not, in state capitals. When you look at certain states where, you know, the largest city may also be the state capital, and, you know, it's going to be kind of tough.
And this is why I think this is the end of public sector unions, this is the death of public sector, some of those takes I think are a little bit overblown. Sure, members will leave. It may even be hundreds of thousands of members who say, no, you know, thanks, but no thanks. I don't want to pay my $25 this week. I don't see any value to it. The big change here is that it's going to force these unions to be accountable to their members. They're going to have to make a case to their members for why they should make that payment. Just like Reason Magazine every month makes a case to its subscribers, right? That you should subscribe to our magazine because there's value there for you. And that's something that unions don't really have to do or didn't really have to do for the last 40 years. Public sector unions knew they were getting this revenue, and so they spent their time and their resources elsewhere. They spent it on politicking. They spent it maybe actually going beyond really their reason for existing in the first place. They're not going to be able to do that anymore. And so I think some union members and union presidents that I've talked to, for example, Ben Johnson, he's a former head of the Vermont chapter of the American Federation of Teachers. He told me a couple months ago, we were talking about the Janus case, and he told me that, you know, in his time running AFT in Vermont, he saw that the union just didn't really care about, you know, membership drives, didn't really care about getting people to sign up because they knew they were getting those dues whether they had members or not. So they made very little effort to actually recruit new members into the union. That's going to have to change, and the way, you know, he put it to me is that unions that make that effort, unions that can show value to their members, are going to be just fine. Unions that do what they're supposed to do are going to, you know, members are still going to want to pay for that.
How is that going to, you know, and I realize this slides a little bit out of the direct question, but with, say, education groups, and again, you know, the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, the two big teacher unions, will they become, on some level, I mean, they're going to have to be more accountable to the members or the people they're trying to represent, but then will they also become, does that come at the cost of being good teachers or not? I mean, like, is there a sense of how does this affect, like, is a really effective union operation, are they extracting all of their, you know, money from taxpayers and kind of indirectly from students?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting, like I said before, this is something that's going to have consequences for a lot of different policies. And that's going to be part of it, is you're going to have, I think, unions. And remember, all these unions are really different, right? Even though, you know, they exist nationally, every individual state chapter kind of runs more or less autonomously. So I think you're going to have states where you have very strong teachers unions and very strong, you know, AFSCME and other public sector unions that will continue to. And so I imagine, you know, in Illinois, where AFSCME is huge, maybe the membership there will be just fine. If you have union leaders that are not interested in retaining members, that have not done a good job of providing value for their members over the years, I think that's where you'll see people choose to leave.
What about for, how does this play out? And I'm thinking of places like Wisconsin when Scott Walker put through Right to Work and whatnot. He wisely, although from a libertarian point of view, very annoyingly exempted, public security or public safety people. So, you know, cops and firemen and in some cases, even like garbage collectors get exempted from these types of things. What kind of effect is this likely to have on, say, police unions?
Yeah, and we see that all the time. When you do, anytime you see like a statewide pension reform that passes, usually you end up with exemptions for state police.
No, and I mean, because in Ohio, you know, they passed a broad-based, I mean, where they got, I think they took everybody in the Right to Work stuff, and it got repealed almost immediately by a ballot initiative because people are, you know, like cops and firemen can really muscle a lot of public support to say, hey, you know what, like, we're different even than teachers. You know, teachers merely I guess, educate the leaders of tomorrow. We keep the leaders of tomorrow alive long enough to be educated.
Well, or the more cynical perspective is that the cops unions give to both parties, right? I mean, they're not as heavy-handed on just giving to Democrats.
Right.
Republicans love their police unions and love their FOP and all that. So, I mean, they have more of a buy-in from both sides. It's not a, it's not a one-sided equation when you do pension reform or whatever it might be, or right to work. I think one of the interesting things that'll play out after this decision is going to be how you see unions try to get around the decision today, because that's almost certainly going to happen. And people like at the National Right to Work Defense Foundation, who are the ones who were backing Janice's challenge, they've already said this, that, they're just gearing up for more litigation in the aftermath of today's ruling, because they expect unions to put all sorts of different riders and clauses on how you can actually get out if you want to opt out of membership. So you'll only be able to opt out if you come down to the union hall on Thursday between noon and 2 p.m., unless it's a full moon. You know, it'll be all sorts of complicated things like that, which this ruling seems to suggest. And actually, Alito goes far enough in here. I haven't been able to dig deeply through the whole thing yet, but some other people who have written that this actually would prohibit unions from requiring payments to get out, which is one way that the one mechanism they could use. And one mechanism they have used in states that have gone to right to work is they've said, okay, sure, you can opt out. Now, state law says you can opt out, but if you want to do that, you have to pay us $500 up front. You know, we're going to get as much out of you as you can before you're out the door.
I've read a couple of early responses from labor people, and they are saying, well, you know what, this might be a shot in the arm, in the same way that, you know, Trump's election, represents, you know, people say it's an existential threat to all that is decent and good smelling in America. So it revitalizes the opposition. Yeah, do you have a sense of that? Does that sound, is that just like they got to say that, or is there a chance that this may, at least in the public sector? Because one of the things that is interesting is when you look at like the flat membership at state and local levels of union, I mean, it hasn't been going down, but it hasn't been going up. So, you know, what's your best take?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it is partially they have to say that because the alternative is to say, well, we're done, I guess. So they have to say that. But on the other hand, I think that's true. I think this will refocus unions on the interests of their workers, which is really what they should be doing. And we could have a debate, and I think there's a legitimate debate to be had about whether public sector unions should even exist. And we talked earlier about FDR. Yeah. You know, I think there's good arguments for these entities shouldn't even exist. But they do. And I think if they're going to, at least today's ruling makes it now so that they will have to put their workers' interests first. They will have to get that buy-in. They will have to be accountable to their own individual members.
So when they less spend parties, money, less par- you know, right. less conventions in Vegas, and more actually saying we want, step increases, things like that.
Sure, and it's maybe it affects their political spending too. Maybe they look at their membership and say, well, you know, look, 30% of our members might be Republicans in some states, right? Should we be spending 99% of our money on electing Democrats? Maybe that's or giving to Democratic causes.
So in other words, this could be really bad. I mean, if you care about reducing the kind of spending of government, like if the unions become more effective as a result of this, that means taxes are going to go up.
They could become more effective, but they will be less politically powerful, I think. The ideal sort of middle road, I think, if I'm putting myself in the shoes of a public sector union executive today after this ruling, is to say, all right, we're going to get leaner. We're going to stop spending money on those trips to Vegas. Maybe we're going to change how we, you know, get involved in politics and elections. We're going to make the case to our workers that we do provide value to them. We're going to work harder, maybe, to get more money out of the state government. But, you know, we're going to have to focus on making sure that we're really responsive to our workers at the expense of other things. So I think it means that they probably have a more narrower focus. Maybe with the correct leadership and with the right buy-in from their employees, maybe they do become more effective. But I think there'll be less, you know, there'll be less money to throw around in politics, which is part of what the unions
final
do.
Question. Is there any connection between kind of the fate of public sector unions and private sector unions? We saw this, talked quite a bit about in the 2016 campaign, and Bernie Sanders in particular, because in a lot of ways, mainstream Democrats and establishment Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, have kind of conceded that the types of work that lent itself to private sector unionization, you know, auto workers, assembly line, stuff like that. You know,
difficult jobs, that sort of thing.
You know, this is one of the things I've had lots of arguments with friends of mine who are progressive on the left, where they claim that the reason why union membership went down in the private sector is, you know, basically because Pinkertons and like, you know, Andrew Carnegie types were, you know, cracking heads and changing rules. To me, it always seems much more convincing that the nature of work that benefited unions. Work is just more individualized. There is fewer assembly line stuff. And like unions, the whole point of them is to take the individual worker and their compensation out of the equation so that you're trying to get the highest average wage for a worker who's doing identical work.
Yeah, the workforce today is more skilled. The blue-collar workforce is certainly more skilled in America than it used to be.
So, is there any connection between this and, and the decline of private sector unions or a possible renaissance of...
I mean, there is in the sense that, like, the unionization, the union movement, they do tend to glom together on big political projects, right? So there is sort of a connection there. But really, no, I think this is going to continue that sort of bifurcation that we've been seeing over the last decade or two, maybe even a little longer than that, you could argue, where private sector unions, are largely going away. And you're seeing those private sector unions now eyeing things like fast food workers, service workers, different, they're trying to grow. They're trying to, regain their numbers or at least stop losing their numbers in other ways. Whereas public sector unions have very different incentives, and certainly after today's decision, now have their incentives have changed for what they're going to be trying to do. So I think it does, it drives a little bit of a gap maybe between those two parts of the labor union, and then you have to filter all of that through Democratic Party politics and the rise of Trump, which has pulled away a lot of maybe what used to be union workers, into maybe what might be a Republican coalition going forward. I don't know, maybe it's just a Trump coalition. But there is, I think there are cultural and political divides there between white-collar public sector workers who are in a union and blue-collar industrial private sector workers who were in a union or maybe still are in a union. And I think that will continue after today.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Eric Boehm. He writes for Reason, and he's talking about the Janus versus AFSCME Supreme Court decision, which said that public sector workers in the 20 states where they still could be forced to pay union dues don't have to anymore. Eric, thanks for talking.
Thanks so much, Nick.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, at wherever you listen to podcasts, and rate and review us wherever you listen. Thanks for listening.